textbook operation, one that would be taught at the Special Forces Training Academy soon enough. He thanked the commander and his team profusely and hung up, privately thanking the gods in whom he did not believe for not needing to use the Z-19 Black Whirlwind attack recon helicopters that had also been deployed for cover. The Bird's Red Arrow missiles were as effective as the American Hellfire, but hardly a surgical instrument. He needed boots on the ground to confirm both the NFLA kills and their identities for his report to his superiors in the Libido Working Group. Most important, the intelligence provided by Chibi had proven both accurate and invaluable to both China and, more significantly, his own career. Clearly, he had misjudged the potential of Chibi's original offer. He would rectify that immediately. Chen dialed the number of the woman who headed his elite cloud hacking unit, APT-15, aka Jade Smoke, a privately owned Hong Kong-based company secretly funded by his department. She picked up on the first ring. "Sir?" Chen asked, "have you ever been to London?" Chapter 65. Washington, D.C. Foley read over the last report again. Something wasn't adding up. The numbers were there, but she couldn't make the algebra work. She spoke Russian fluently. Mary Patricia Kaminsky Foley had learned the elegant form of the language at her grandfather's knee and was a field agent in Moscow while her husband Ed served as Moscow chief of station. She knew the language, the people, and the politics as well as any outsider could ever understand the place Churchill described as a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. As a Russia expert during the Cold War, she knew its operational history in Africa. Angola had fallen to the indigenous communists with Moscow's support. But the country, a former Portuguese colony, was Castro's play on the continent, a massive Cuban military intervention. At the time, America feared the domino theory in Africa. The worries seemed frivolous now, in hindsight. She'd never heard of Libido or the NFLA. But dead Chinese nationals in Angola were a red flag. Her intuition was flashing DEFCON 3. 10 days earlier, an Argentinian special operations team had been shot out of the sky by Iranian-backed Hezbollah operatives. That had been a head-scratcher, too. So was the killing of the Turkish Maroon Berets in Syria. A hell of a provocation by the Russians. And then the NFLA, discovered, located, and utterly wiped out in a single surgical strike in a matter of days. Chinese intel in Africa couldn't be that good, could it? Hell, the CIA didn't even know anything about the NFLA until Portuguese Foreign Intelligence reached out for a NATO consult just a few days ago. Unlike the spy movies, the real game wasn't usually played for keeps. In peacetime, killing the opposition was a serious escalation of the stakes and an open invitation for a retaliatory strike, usually disproportional in its violence and damage, to discourage future incivility. That's why the killing of the German BKA agent by an unknown agency was so disturbing. But the three other attacks were equally problematic. The four attacks were geographically separated: South America, the Middle East, Africa, and Europe. The three military operations by Iran, Russia, and China were against a state police force, the Turkish military, and an indigenous rebel group, respectively. The fourth attack, technically the first on the calendar, was a street murder of an undercover agent working on a drug case by knifing him in the back. They all seemed so different. What was the connection? She couldn't see it, but she could damn well feel it. What was the same about them? Not the weapons, not the victims, not the objectives. They were all so different in so many ways, and yet something connected them. She was sure of it. But what? Think, damn it. Her husband, Ed, now retired, was the cerebral one in the family. Poker-faced and taciturn even as a young man, he remained detached and analytical when challenged. She was the one who wanted to go over the wall or through the window with a pistol in her hand, the one they nicknamed Cowboy, until she put a stop to it. But she knew even back then that intelligence work, like science, was first and foremost an act of observation. From observation came comparisons, and from comparisons, conclusions. How were things the same? How different? The ability to categorize was an exercise as old as Genesis, when God told Adam to name the animals. She had sketched out all of the differences among these events in her mind. What was the same among them? The Argentines were blasted out of the sky after they were lured into a trap. The Turks were blown away by a long-range missile strike. The NFLA were killed while they slept in a surprise ground assault. The undercover BKA agent was ambushed in a faked robbery. If there was any similarity among the four attacks, it was that each mission required a piece of intelligence. Well, duh, doesn't every operation? But the quality of intel each of these operations required was both specific and significant. What was the source? Could all four attacks be related to a single source? No. How could they be? It just didn't add up. You're getting too old for this stuff, Mary Pat, she told herself. Maybe Ed was right. Time to take up golf and start playing with him and his buddies at the club. She shook her head at the idea. Not yet, kiddo. Not yet. She picked up her phone and dialed Jesse Benson, the CIA's National Counterintelligence Executive, NCIX, the best number cruncher in the business and an old friend. He was still in PT for a double knee replacement, but he was already back at the job. She briefed him and sent him a link to the four reports. Jesse, I can smell the smoke, but I can't see the fire. What priority? Yesterday would be preferable, but ASAP will have to do. I've got a bad feeling about this. Then I'll handle it personally, Mary Pat. I was hoping you'd say that. Say, when are you and Melinda coming over for dinner next? It's been too long. Let me get this done for you, and then we'll check our calendars. Thanks, Jesse. She ended the call. If anyone could pull a rabbit out of a hat in record time, it was Jesse. She just hoped the rabbit wasn't stuffed with C4 on a timer and set to blow before Jesse worked his magic. Chapter 66. San Francisco, California. Lawrence Fung checked the radar. All clear. He stomped the gas pedal, and the Porsche 911 Targa's 370-horsepower engine responded in kind, rocketing past the speed limit. Racing the car on the winding Pacific Coast Highway was dangerous and thrilling, exactly where Fung loved to be every moment of his life. The phone call from Elias Dom he'd received a few hours earlier felt exactly the same way. Fung wasn't sure if he was speeding toward a brilliant future or a fiery crash. Dom's invitation to a private dinner with him at his pleasure palace in Marin County was a stunning development. It was tantamount to being asked to sing a duet with Mariah Carey or play one-on-one with LeBron James. Dom was the brightest star in the Silicon Valley firmament. It was an invitation to Mount Olympus to dine with Apollo, the god of light and beauty. Fung had been to his house before, but always as part of a large social event. Dom was famous for his bacchanalian parties disguised as perfectly orchestrated networking events, lubricated with copious amounts of expensive liquor and premium weed. The last time he'd been to one of Dom's parties was with Torre several months ago. A pang of longing shot through him, but he pushed it aside. He needed to focus. Being invited to Dom's place alone was a singular honor. But it made no sense. Why invite him now? Why on such short notice? For all of his physical beauty and charisma, Dom was nobody's fool, a true genius in his own right. His scores of sexual conquests were a careful camouflage, Fung suspected. Portraying himself to be a libertine and hedonistic playboy, Dom was, in fact, a cunning and controlling intellect whose lifelong love was only himself and the company he had built. Anyone threatening him or his kingdom would be ruthlessly destroyed. Dom had ruined careers, no doubt. But Fung knew of at least one competitor who simply disappeared. Whether he was bought off or knocked off, no one knew for sure. If Dom suspected that Fung was leaking IC Cloud intel, he was doomed one way or another. But then again, how could Dom know? With Dom's cliffside mansion coming into view, he couldn't help but wonder if tonight was a seduction or an execution. Dom's personal chef and sommelier did not disappoint. The two of them feasted like kings on grilled Wagyu tenderloin, fresh-cut organic greens, garlic and thyme fondant potatoes, and a fine Napa Valley Reserve Cabernet Sauvignon. They dined near the infinity pool overlooking the Pacific Ocean, warmed against the slight chill breeze by a limestone fire pit. The conversation had been light and witty as they discussed their favorite local indie bands, Italian neorealist films, pop-up restaurants, and vacation destinations. With the sumptuous meal consumed and the mood lightened by a second bottle of wine, Dom's radiant smile suddenly softened. A single gesture of his finger sent the lovely young server scurrying away. They were alone now. "So glad we finally did this," Dom began. "I can't believe it's taken us this long to get together." "It's been a fabulous evening. I can't thank you enough." "Nonsense. It's me who should be thanking you. You're one of my most important people doing one of the most important jobs. CloudSurf wouldn't be where it is today without you." "I'm just following in Amanda's wake. She's the real rock star." Dom huffed. "Yes, well, Amanda. Brilliant, no doubt. But I imagine she'd be difficult to work under." He took another sip of wine. "She has taught me a lot, but yes, Amanda is uniquely herself." "You're far too smart, and I suspect ambitious, to remain a number two. What are your long-term plans?" "I love my job at CloudSurf. The opportunity to keep rising in the ranks is my immediate goal."
"And after that?"
"You know what they say about rock stars? You either want to be them or to fuck them." Fung instantly regretted the comment. The wine had loosened his tongue. But it was true. Dom really was the ultimate rock star. He wanted to be just like him. And he really wanted to...
"Careful what you ask for," Dom smiled. "It's lonely at the top, and there's only one way to go from there."
He refilled Fung's wine glass and his own. "It's a risk I'm willing to take."
"I'm glad to hear it. Because, to be honest, you worry me."
Fung panicked.
"How is that?" "You're too smart to stay inside of any organization, even one as dynamic as mine."
Dom leaned closer. "The reason I invited you here is because I see you as a threat."
"Me? Why?"
"Because I see myself in you. The same hungry look, the same fire in the belly. You're willing to risk everything just to test the boundaries other lesser minds want to impose upon you. You know your own greatness and the chains of mediocrity that others would bind you with."
Fung took a sip of wine, evaluating Dom's face over the rim of his glass. The compliments Dom threw at him were an endorphin rush he'd hardly felt before. Better than a first kiss. Better than...
Where was this going? "Society has rules. Governments have rules. It's all bullshit," Dom said. "To reach one's potential, one must live beyond these conventions. Nationalism, patriotism, progressivism,
All these isms are just shackles the midwits impose upon us to keep us away from the sun. Don't you agree? Fung suspected maximum danger here, but also maybe an opportunity. I'm grateful for America and what it has done for my family and for me. As am I. You know, I was born in Holland, but my parents immigrated to this country when I was only two. You and I are both hungry because we are immigrants, or the children of immigrants. That's what makes America great, isn't it? The constant influx of hungry, ambitious immigrants. Chinese and other Asian communities especially. By the way, most people don't know this, but my father was born in what used to be called the Dutch East Indies, but is now known as Indonesia. He was half Dutch and half Chinese. Oh, really? Fascinating. And while I'm as grateful as you are for the opportunities this country has given me, it's clear as day that the future belongs to China. Don't you agree? Fung studied the handsome face across the table. The clear blue eyes seemed to devour him, like a lover or a killer. Fung wasn't sure which. Yes, Fung agreed. Western liberal democracies seem to be standing on their last legs. The China model appears to be more stable and dynamic. Exactly. And to hell with all governments, by the way, including China's. Laws are only the tools of the powerful few to keep the rest of us in line. It certainly feels that way at times. And so now you know why my focus is on China. CloudServe needs to expand aggressively there before it's too late. And I think you are the man to help us get there. Why? Because I'm ethnic Chinese. Yes. But a brilliant and driven ethnic Chinese with language and cultural skills, along with the perfect hacker skill sets needed for the task at hand. Fung's blood pressure rose. Where is this going? You're the head of IC Cloud Red Team, which means you have management skills, and most important of all, you think like a hacker. Dom laughed. I sure as hell wouldn't want you coming after me. Now Fung's alarm bells were screaming. What are you proposing, exactly? I want you to start your own China-focused cybersecurity company. Build it from the ground up. It will be your company, your vision, your baby, but tethered to CloudServe for protection and support. For what purpose? To hack the Chinese? Or the U.S.? Both, certainly. But legally. You'd be offering the Chinese and American governments a safe and secure way to check for vulnerabilities in any system anywhere. The money potential is limitless. I'm stunned. I don't know what to say. Dom sat back. Look, let me be perfectly honest. If you went out and started your own company, which eventually you would, at some point we'd be going to war, and I'd do everything I could to destroy you. I'm speaking business-wise, of course. We're not actual killers, are we? He smiled mischievously. Fung's eyes widened. I sure hope not. I prefer instead that we form an alliance, here and now. I want you to achieve your wildest dreams, but I want you to do it as my partner, not my competitor. What do you think? It's a dream come true. I just don't know how to wrap my mind fully around it. Of course, with the CloudServe board and the SEC breathing down my neck, it's going to be up to you to raise the capital. It will take millions. But that won't be hard for you, will it? Again, Fung was confused, thrilled, and panicked. What was Dom suggesting? Fung was like CloudServe itself. Fantastic cash flow, but always on the verge of bankruptcy. If Dom knew that, they wouldn't be having this conversation. Or would they? Chibi knew all about it and played on his vulnerabilities. Was Dom doing the same thing as Chibi? Wait, what?
No.
It couldn't be.
Could it?
I'm not exactly a venture capitalist myself, Elias. I'm not sure how I could be your point man for raising that kind of money. You helped start a couple of unicorns. Yeah, they went belly up, but they were good bets. I even had a little money on one of them. You just need to go back to the VC people that funded those projects with a virtual letter of intent from me, and raising the money shouldn't be a problem. What do you think? I'm beyond flattered. Everything in me tells me to jump at this. Do you mind if I take 24 hours to give you an answer? No, not at all, Dom said. He stood and stretched his 6'4 athletic frame. Are you ready for dessert?
Sure.
Great. I'll be right back. Dom then disappeared into the house. Fung was sipping his wine when Roberto suddenly appeared, ripped like a swimmer and wearing nothing but a speedo and a smile.
Roberto?
Fung was confused. The tall Brazilian laid a familiar hand on Fung's shoulder.
I hope you're hungry, because I'm the dessert.
Fung set his wine glass down. Roberto stepped toward the edge of the infinity pool just a few feet away.
Care to join me?
He pulled off his swimsuit. Fung leered at the marbled Adonis standing in front of him. His confusion melted into lust. How could Dom possibly know about Roberto, his favorite?
He couldn't.
Could he?
No.
But Chibi could.
Yeah. A swim. Sounds delicious.
Chapter 67. Alexandria, Virginia. Jack sat on his couch, staring into space, a half-finished beer warm in his hand. What had happened in the Baltic a few days ago still gripped him like a waking nightmare. Lying on his back in the frigid sea, numb from the cold and exhausted, he had closed his eyes and surrendered to the sleep overwhelming him, knowing he'd never wake again in this life. But here he was now, very much awake and alive. His nerves were frayed and his heart shattered. Rage, grief, and guilt were numbing him as badly as the Baltic had that night. Liliana's terrified face disappearing into the merciless gloom looped endlessly in his mind's eye. For a moment in the hospital bed at the Polish clinic, he imagined he really had died and the image repeating in his mind was his own personal hell. A knock on his front door broke the loop and got him off the couch. Hey, kid. Mind if I come in? John Clark stood in the doorway. Just slightly taller than Jack, but with a leaner frame. The former SEAL was his boss at the campus and also a close friend. The 70-something-year-old man still trained with the team he led, which explained why he looked 20 years younger than he actually was. Jack's body language said, go away. He motioned him in with his bottle anyway. Yeah, sure. Come in. Clark saw the beer. I'll have what you're having. Jack shuffled toward the kitchen. He pulled a bottle out of the fridge and handed it to Clark. Clark popped the top and clinked his bottle against Jack's bottle. I heard you checked out fine on your physical. He took a swig. That's what the doctor said. You look good. Tired, maybe. Didn't sleep much last night. Otherwise, I'm good to go. You mind telling that to your old man? He called me today. Jack's eyes narrowed. I sent him a text. Not the same thing. In fact, your folks were hoping you'd stop by. They'd love to put their arms around your neck and see for themselves. Jack headed back toward the front room and fell onto the couch. Clark took a chair and another swig of beer. It's one thing to not call your dad, but you really should call your mom. Trust me on this. Jack shook his head, frustrated.
the President of the United States dispatched one of the finest warriors this country has ever produced just to get him to call his mommy. They know I'm okay. I'm just not ready to talk. He looked Clark straight in the eye. To anybody. Clark ignored him. I get it, kid. I read the report Lizanne put together. You're lucky to be alive. Lizanne's debrief chilled Clark to the bone when he read it. Jack should be dead. If that Polish fisherman had repaired his motor 10 minutes earlier and headed back to port, he would have missed Jack entirely. Covering him in blankets, the fisherman got Jack to a clinic on shore just in time. They pumped him with warm saline solution and got his body temperature back to normal before any permanent damage was sustained. You should be grateful to the man upstairs, Jack. Not sulking around the apartment feeling sorry for yourself. Jack's jaw clenched. You don't know what happened that night. Enlighten me. The only reason I'm alive isn't luck. It's the fact that the bastard knew I worked for Jerry Hendley. How'd they find out? Liliana must have told them to save my life. It worked. But it didn't save hers. That's not on you. You did everything you could, including risking your own life to save hers. You don't understand. The hell I don't. During the war, Clark had been forced to stand by and watch a Vietnamese family get slaughtered one by one before he finally decided to act against his orders. He stopped the killing, but got shot for the effort and nearly died. All you can do is give it your best effort. You can't control the outcome. She got caught trying to protect me. That was her job, and I'd say she did it well, judging by the fact you're sitting here breathing and feeling sorry for yourself. I should have kept her out of the op, should have gone in all by myself without her knowing. So why didn't you? She was a professional. I didn't really think there would be a problem. I liked working with her. And it was her case, too. Did you force her to go? Lie to her, or bribe her, or threaten her in any way to get her to go? No, of course not. Then I don't see the problem. She was doing her job, and you were doing yours. You know by now, kid, what we do ain't all sunshine and rainbows. And the worst damn enemy we ever face isn't out there. It's the guy staring back at you in the mirror every morning. You need to get a handle on this, Jack. She had a kid. A little boy. Tomasz. The image of her screaming out his name as she sank into the gloom flashed across his mind again. He drowned it with a long pull of beer, draining the bottle. His dad was killed a few years back in Afghanistan. And now this. It's so damn unfair. I know it is. And I don't know how to sort it all out on this side of heaven. That's why I let the priests handle all of that metaphysical stuff. I can't control what I can't control. And by the way, thanks to your call from that clinic, the boy and his grandmother are sequestered in a Polish safe house right now. So quit kicking yourself in the ass. Yeah. A phone call. Big hero. For what it's worth, your dad pulled a few strings. The Brits are sending over a deep water submersible to the location that Polish fisherman gave us. He wasn't too specific, but with any luck, they might be able to find your friend and maybe even get her back to her family for a decent burial. Jack darkened. Yeah, that would be something, at least. They sat in silence for a while. Clark watched Jack falling deeper into his hole. That guy you sent on a wild goose chase, what was his name? Gorowski. Yeah, that's right. He wound up in Dusseldorf. They picked him up, but he didn't tell the cops anything. A high-dollar attorney bailed him out a few hours ago. They couldn't hold him for anything because he had all of his legal permits to do whatever it was he was doing. And apparently it's not against the law over there to tail somebody. He chuckled. That was a pretty slick move you pulled on him, kid. What about Christopher Gage? He was questioned, gently, because of his stepmom, the senator. But he has an alibi for that night, and he said he had no idea what was going on at the warehouse. He just leased it out. According to the embassy guys, he seemed genuinely surprised and upset to hear what happened to you and the girl. And unless he threatened you or you saw him at the warehouse or on that boat, there's nothing else to be done. Innocent until proven guilty, right? I know who's guilty. You mean the Foreign Legion paratrooper? I'm gonna cut his fucking heart out. Gotta find him first.
Can't be too hard. I was thinking about it on the flight over. Even did a little research between naps. That tattoo I saw was 2nd Parachute Regiment of the French Foreign Legion. They have 1,300 enlisted officers and men at any given time. Can't be that many blonde guys aged 18 to 35 over the last 17 years in an elite unit like that.
That's a good start. I'll back your play any way I can.
I need Gavin to do his hack magic. Is he available yet?
Jerry told me that Gavin is back in the saddle starting tomorrow morning. I'll be sure he gets right on it.
Jack rose to fetch another beer.
You want another one?
Still working on this one.
Jack yanked open the refrigerator door.
They find the Baltic Princess yet?
Yeah. She's somewhere in the middle of the Gobi Desert.
Jack frowned as he unscrewed the cap.
What are you talking about?
That ship spoofed itself. Our people did a search of her AIS signal, but they must have turned it off, because she wasn't showing up on anybody's radar. But about an hour ago, the ship's signal popped up in the Gobi Desert. Some joker must have pulled the box, put it on a plane, and then shipped it by camel out there, just to shoot us a big middle finger.
That's just great.
Jack took a long pull of his beer, lost in thought. Clark saw the wheels grinding behind the younger man's eyes.
So, what's the plan now?
I've got something I've got to do.
I got to prove to myself I can keep a promise and not fuck it up.
Does Jerry know about this?
He knows I was planning on this trip before he sent me to Poland.
When do you plan on leaving?
Tomorrow.
How long will you be gone?
A day down, a day there at most, a day back. 3 days tops.
You need any of us for backup?
No, this isn't an op.
It's a favor for an old friend who died just 2 weeks ago. But I need to do it.
So you'll do a friend a favor, but you won't do the right thing by your mom?
I just can't talk about anything right now. I need to process it.
Makes sense. But you can still call her and tell her you're okay, and we'll see her in a few days.
Clark had a way of making a suggestion into an order without seeming to.
Besides,
he was right, Jack admitted to himself.
He would call his mom,
then finalize his trip plans.
A visit to the parsonage, his dad's name for the free public housing known as the White House, would have to wait until he settled his account with Corey and got his head screwed back on straight. After that, he'd go hunting.
Chapter 68. Washington, D.C. It was late. Ed was fast asleep, and Mary Pat Foley's raging headache only worsened as she reread Jesse Benson's report, freshly arrived over the digital transom 15 minutes earlier. She took no comfort in the realization that her instincts were spot on, but it had taken a CIA supercomputer with AI analytical software to confirm her gut sense with hard data. Benson's report took it one step further. He believed a fifth incident preceding the other four was part of the mix. The liquidation of a Chinese asset working in the quantum satellite program at Hefei. The statistical analysis of the five attacks revealed a nearly imperceptible pattern. All five were connected to a single CIA comm satellite managed by the NRO. Access to this satellite was, in effect, access to the entire Western intelligence community, or at least any communication that transmitted through this particular bird. Equally disturbing was the company that put it into orbit, Elias Dom's Space Serve, Even more troubling was the fact that its parent company, CloudServe, had secured the satellite's connection to the IC cloud. Clearly, they had dropped the ball. But what to do about it? The IC had moved all of its data and communications into the cloud in order to improve its cybersecurity. Now the cloud was proving to be the avenue of this particular security breach. Sounding the general alarm would put the entire IC cloud program in jeopardy, or worse, put the IC itself into a general state of paralysis. The only way to prevent a flooding ship from sinking was to dog the doors between compartments in order to contain the damage to the smallest possible location and stop the flow of water. The same would apply here. IC departments would want to lock down to prevent further data leakage, but that would defeat the purpose of the cloud, namely, to increase the flow of information throughout the community. The other challenge was the lack of specific data. Benson's analysis had strongly suggested, but not proved, that the comm satellite was the common link and therefore the leak in the system. But who was accessing the satellite? How did they do it? How long had it been going on? Did others have access? Were other satellites at risk? Was the cloud-space-serve connection a coincidence? Was the satellite breached, or the cloud itself? 100 other questions flooded her mind, but without specifics, there was nothing actionable. If there was a leak in the boat, they had to find its exact location and determine its size in order to plug it. Foley needed more information, and the best person to provide it was the head of the IC Cloud security team, Amanda Watson. Watson had made a hell of an impression on Foley, a smart, patriotic young woman who was succeeding brilliantly in a largely male and progressive culture that wasn't exactly known for waving American flags. More to the point, Watson had designed much of the cloud software to begin with and designed the IC Cloud security program. If anyone would be able to answer the questions she now had, it would be Amanda. Foley shot an email to her executive assistant to arrange an immediate and secure face-to-face with Ms. Watson, ASAP. Chapter 69. Alexandria, Virginia. Jack packed light. It was going to be only 3 days, and worst-case scenario, he could wash his clothes in a river or something. Or better yet, pull a Jack Reacher and just buy some cheap local stuff and not bother with doing any laundry. The Uber driver, a polite and soft-spoken young Afghan immigrant named Mohammed, a former translator for the U.S. Army, picked him up in front of his apartment and headed for Dulles International in heavy rush hour traffic. It was just after 5. Neither man noticed the battered blue Toyota Corolla following in the distance, nor the man driving it. An acne-scarred ex-Pinkerton man by the name of Tyler. Hiding his bloodshot eyes behind a pair of Oakleys, Tyler was determined not to lose sight of Jack Ryan Jr. He wanted to impress his new employer, Sandra Kyle, after losing John Clark on a previous tale a few days back. Reassigned to Jr., this was his chance to prove his worth. The Uber driver dropped Jack off with his carry-on backpack at arrival door 6 at Dulles International Airport and sped away. Tyler managed to snap a photo of Jack as well as the Uber license plate before pulling back into traffic. Tyler texted his photos to Kyle before calling her. She rang back immediately. He couldn't tell her what airline Jack was heading for or where he was going. Following Jack in wasn't an option unless Jack was planning on buying a ticket at the counter, which was highly unlikely. He would simply pass through ticketed security and disappear into one of the two insanely long Dulles terminal buildings, where nobody could follow without a ticket. Since Ryan had only a single piece of carry-on luggage, he was no doubt grabbing a domestic flight taking off within the hour, if not two. Tyler agreed that this information didn't help narrow much of anything down. Several hundred flights were taking off in that two-hour window to all points of the compass connecting to the rest of the planet. To prove his mettle, he requested and received permission to question the Afghan later that night, preferably in the man's home with a gun to his young wife's head. Something a tribal man will understand, he assured her. Kyle agreed, and promised to forward the Afghan's address within the hour. In the meantime, the paunchy ex-Pinkerton man was feeling a powerful thirst. DC Metro traffic was snarled at this time of day, but 20 minutes later he managed to shuffle into a busy strip mall Irish pub he frequented. Tyler climbed onto his favorite stool just as a shot glass of Jameson and a draft PBR were set on the bar in front of him. Two failed marriages cost him his house and wiped out his pension. At least the shitty per diem Kyle paid was in cash so he could avoid paying taxes, and more important, wage garnishments from his ex-wife's blood-sucking attorneys. A couple of trips to O'Hare's each week was his one solace, and the guy behind the bar, an ex-cop, charged him only half price, thanks to some nasty PI photos of the man's wife he'd provided in a vicious custody battle. The second round arrived as a dark-eyed Mexican about his age took the stool next to him. They nodded a silent greeting before the bartender asked, "What'll you have?" The Mexican ordered a club soda. Tyler fought back a grin as he tossed back the whiskey. What was the point of ordering a club soda? He chugged his beer and wiped the foam from his mouth with his hand, relishing the familiar burn in the back of his throat. He pulled a 10 from his wallet as he stood, tossing it onto the bar. "Sit down." The Mexican was talking to his club soda. Tyler couldn't believe his ears. "Excuse me? You deaf? I said sit the hell down." The Mexican turned to him. Ding Chavez was a half head shorter than Tyler, but the soul-snatching eyes boring into him suggested the smaller man was not to be trifled with. "I won't say it again." Tyler wobbled uneasily in place, weighing the options in his booze-addled brain. "You buying?" "Sure." The fat man sat and waved for another round for himself. "What do you want to know?" Tyler asked. "Why you're tailing people from Hendley Associates." "What does that matter to you?" "The shovel in the trunk of my car thinks it's important." Tyler nearly shat himself. This some bitch wasn't kidding. "I need to take a piss." Ding took a sip of club soda. "Talk first, then piss." "I really gotta piss." "Then talk fast or piss yourself. I don't care which, but you ain't moving." Tyler talked, his tongue loosened by two more rounds of Boilermakers, and the vision of ending the evening lying on his back in the cold ground with his face covered in freshly spaded earth. Washington, D.C. Amanda Watson's face paled like she was about to vomit. Mary Pat Foley was on a secure, encrypted video chat line with the senior CloudServe executive in her San Francisco office. "I don't know what to say, Madam Director. First of all, my friends call me Mary Pat." The DNI needed Watson to gather her wits and calm herself down. Foley could only imagine the guilt and embarrassment she must be feeling at the moment. "Well, Mary Pat, if you hadn't sent me your analysis, my first response would have been to say it isn't possible. But the numbers are pretty damn convincing. It would be easy for me to pass this off as a satellite and hardware problem, but my instinct is that the report is onto something. You and me both. That's why I reached out to you. I think you see my dilemma. Without specifics, I can't find the bastard behind these leaks, let alone nail his scalp to the wall." Watson leaned back in her chair, her eyes narrowing in thought. "The reason why your report bugs me so much is that I thought I had discovered a problem with part of that very same satellite uplink code a few months ago. You know, we're always searching for vulnerabilities in our systems, and I put my best man on it. He said the vulnerability was there, but it was minimal and, to the best of his knowledge, had never been exploited. He patched it and we moved on. Is it possible he missed something? Another vulnerability, perhaps?" "No. We ran diagnostics up and down after he patched. It was bulletproof." Foley sighed. The worst American spy scandals in history weren't perpetrated by foreign agents, but by American traitors. Aldrich Ames was CIA, as Edward Snowden had been before he began working for an NSA private contractor. Robert Hansen was FBI. Pollard and Walker were both Navy. It was as likely as not that this breach was an inside job as well. I hate to ask, but do you trust your man on this? Watson frowned. Funny you should ask. Larry Fung is one of the smartest guys I've ever worked with. Up until recently, I would have pounded the desk in his defense. What's changed your mind? Watson shook her head, obviously disgusted with herself. He's passed every in-house security audit, and his TS clearance is active, so there's no reason to suspect him, right? But in my counter-intel briefings, I was told to watch for certain behavioral signs. And that whole mice thing. The guy likes to play martyr, and he's bleeding cash as near as I can tell. I thought you Silicon Valley types were all rolling in dough. We get paid very well, but not the kind of money you think. And between federal and state taxes, we lose almost half of that. The big payoff is in stock options, and Elias has been very generous with those for me and Larry in particular. The problem is, the way he guarantees the NDAs and non-competes we sign is that he holds our stocks in escrow for 5 years after the last date of our employment. Is that legal? Legal? Yes. But not ethical. Certainly effective. So Larry's got to wait quite a while to cash in his CloudServe lottery ticket. Money is a powerful motivator. So are the other incentives. Ideology. Coercion. And ego. That's why I started nosing around a little a few days ago. Never found anything, and never caught him doing something he shouldn't be doing. But then again, he's so damn smart he could hide his tracks, and he would, wouldn't he, if he were up to no good. I know the man. He's careful, methodical, and precise. You almost sound as if you're saying the fact you couldn't find any evidence against him is the best proof he's guilty. I know. It's ridiculous, and that's why I ultimately dismissed my concerns out of hand. But the coincidence between your report and the fact he worked on this very problem sent chills down my spine. And in that nosing around I told you about, I discovered that my computer had been searching the NRO workstation you identified in your report. The problem is, I never accessed that workstation. I checked the date and time in question and thought I was losing my mind. Until I pulled up my Uber receipt for that night. Bottom line is someone accessed my computer to check out the NRO workstation without my knowledge. And you suspect Fung. Your report practically confirms it. He was the last person in the office after me that night. If I didn't know any better, it's almost as if he wanted to leave my digital fingerprints on that machine to point at me if some problem were ever discovered. Isn't your computer biometrically passcoded? Yes, but the Red Team has developed a device called Passprint to overcome that kind of security and... Watson shut her eyes. I'm such an idiot. What? Larry was the point person heading that up. How do you want to proceed? Let me start by first rechecking the satellite software all over again and running a new diagnostic. I think it's important we find tangible evidence that this really is a problem. Not taking anything away from your people, but correlation isn't proof. I'd like to nail that down, and if I can do that, it might yield more clues. How long? Time is not our friend here. I can have something to you by EOB today at the latest. Good. While you're banging away on that, I'll have some of my people begin a discreet inquiry into Mr. Fung. Yes. Please do. And discreet is the operative word. He's innocent until proven guilty, and if we're wrong about him and he finds out what we're doing, he'll be outraged, and I'll lose one of my best people for no good reason. Worse, he'd blab about this thing all over town just to ruin our reputation. Maybe even sue us. I understand completely. We'll keep everything under wraps. I look forward to hearing from you by end of business today. Will do. And please, keep me posted on anything you find out about Larry. You have my word on that, Foley promised. The video call ended, and Mary Pat texted the director of the NSA's counter-intel outfit,
referred to in the media as the Q Group, requesting assistance on the Fung matter. Chibi read the text exchanges between Foley and Q Group a few hours later, highly amused. Chapter 70. Cielo Santo, Peru. The overnight flight from Dulles to Jorge Chavez in Lima was the fastest Jack could find, but it still had a layover in Dallas. His only luggage was a carry-on Osprey Farpoint 40 backpack toting the bare essentials. Arriving a little after 5 in the morning, he splashed his face with cold water in the men's restroom after he deplaned. He grabbed a venti drip, dark roast, no-room Starbucks coffee, waiting until 7 before boarding a one-hour puddle jumper to the regional airstrip near Anta in Carhuaz province north of Lima. In the colorful and scrupulously clean little town of a few thousand, Jack found the store he'd located on the internet, where he purchased a flimsy but serviceable folding knife and a disposable lighter, two items he couldn't carry on a plane. They were already over 8,000 feet, the air cooling considerably from Lima's. A snow-capped peak loomed in the distance beyond the low hills surrounding the town. From Anta, he caught a brightly painted GMC school bus that made the long and winding climb high into the Andes. The bus was crowded with locals, mostly working-class men, to judge from their calloused hands, worn clothes, and meager belongings. Short-statured, with dark almond-shaped eyes and sharp, broad noses, the indigenous Quechua rode shoulder to shoulder in grim silence. The man next to Jack on the bench seat sat silent as a stone the entire trip, staring wordlessly out of the windows. Jack didn't mind. He didn't feel like talking anyway. 2 hours into the four-hour trip, the blue skies darkened and rain fell like Noah's flood. The unexpected torrent surprised Jack. This wasn't the rainy season, according to his brief weather research. This far south of the equator, the weather was flipped from Virginia's. It was supposed to be approaching Peruvian summer, but the chill air suggested the mountains hadn't checked their calendars yet. The steepening climb slowed the straining engine, and the bus rumbled through the mud and rocks washing over the pavement. The wipers slapped furiously at the sheets of water blinding the windshield, and the low clouds shrouded the stunning beauty of the Andes. Just after noon, the bus screeched to a halt at its terminus in Cielo Santo, Jack's destination. The driver killed the noisy V8. No one spoke. Jack stood a head and a half taller than the men in front of and behind him, the rain drumming the roof just inches above his ball cap. He pulled on his disposable emergency poncho and followed the others into the storm as they shuffled off the bus and into one of Dante's circles of hell. Cielo Santo wasn't on any map Jack could find, but Corey told him he wouldn't. Originally, it was a quaint alpine village nestled at the foot and midway between the looming twin peaks of La Hermana Alta and El Hermano Gordo. It stood approximately 13,000 feet above the Pacific Ocean, which was less than 100 miles to the west, typical of Peru's dramatic topography. According to Corey, a gold rush in the 40s had exploded the population to a few thousand and expanded the number of buildings to include at least one hotel, La Vicuña Roja. When the gold ran out in the 60s and the government made further mining in the region illegal in the 90s, the miners left, but the adventure tourists came, including Corey's father, who had climbed La Hermana as a young man. Standing beneath the thundering steel roof at the bus terminal, a gas station, Jack surveyed the rain-soaked gloom around him. Unlike the clean and neatly ordered villages like Anta he'd seen previously, Cielo Santo was the Peruvian version of Deadwood. The street he surveyed was lined by rusted, faded, and crumbling two- and three-story buildings, with skeins of improvised power lines webbing the sky overhead. The rain hadn't quite washed away the stench of diesel where he stood, or the garbage and urine from an alley behind him. Dozens of dark-faced Quechua in ponchos and rain gear stood in knots beneath leaking awnings or hustled up and down the muddy, trash-strewn street. Others wore construction helmets and heavy rubber boots, carrying tools or plastic buckets, like miners. Jack had read that with the economy tanking, desperate Peruvians, mostly Quechua and mestizos, engaged in illegal mining operations that had popped up all over the Andes, rummaging through the tailings or attempting to revive abandoned gold and silver mines, like the ones in the mountains above the town. Corey's instructions told Jack where to find La Vicuña Roja, the hotel bar where his father had stayed decades before. Corey had written everything down for Jack, but the tone in his deathbed voice carried the weight of the unfulfilled promise he had made to his father to climb La Hermana together. The two of them had hiked a dozen mountains together in America before his father died when Corey was still in college. His tragic death had cut short their plans to travel to Peru together for a trekking adventure, including La Hermana near Cielo Santo, where his dad lived for a time. Jack touched the hollow wooden amulet hanging around his neck for the thousandth time, an unconscious check to make sure Corey's ashes were still in place, but also to connect once again with his dead friend. Jack also carried a faded Polaroid of Corey's dad standing on the peak. Jack's mission was to carry the picture, along with a small portion of Corey's ashes, to the top of La Hermana and scatter them so that Corey could keep his promise to his father to one day climb it together, and then to bury the photo on the spot where his dad had stood. Jack's promise was to keep Corey's promise to his father, and he was determined to keep it no matter what. Corey estimated Jack could make the trek up the steep incline in 5 hours, most of it walking a rugged trail with the last 100 meters being an easy hand climb over granite boulders. The plan was to hit the trail by 1 o'clock and arrive at the peak just as the sun was setting, then make his way back down with a flashlight and grab the noon bus back to Anta the next day, reversing his trip and winding up back in D.C. by 3 p.m. the day after tomorrow. It was a good plan, until the rain killed it. Chapter 71. Jack worked his way from the gas station toward the hotel, past makeshift shanties of plastic and tin, splashing in puddles and stepping over a few drunks passed out in the alleys. There weren't any sidewalks in the shitty Shangri-La. The Vicuña Roja sign showed just that, a hand-painted red animal that looked a lot like a llama, its larger domesticated cousin. Jack's original schedule precluded a visit here, but with the rain knocking down his plans for the day, he figured it might be the only place in town to find a room for the night. He headed inside. Heavy chopper blades beat the air in the distance. The hotel's first floor was a run-down little bar, dark and depressing and stinking of cigar smoke. Waylon Jennings twanged on the jukebox speakers. Dusty trophies of stuffed rainbow trout, geese, and ducks hung on the smoke-stained walls. The Anglo man behind the bar was leaning on the counter, fixated on a newspaper and nursing a whiskey. A cigar smoldered in an ashtray near his elbow. Jack had shaken off as much rain as he could outside, but he was still dripping onto the faded vinyl flooring. A mestizo woman with bad makeup, a too small dress, and the figure of a Christmas ham sat in the back corner with a brooding Quechua man seated next to her, his arms folded across his round belly, staring bleary-eyed at the wall. Tall bottles of Peruvian beer stood on the table in front of them. She flashed Jack a propositional smile through heavy red lipstick, but he declined with his own polite smile and a slight shake of his head. Another patron in a cheap suit and cowboy boots was passed out in the other corner, snoring on his folded arms. A half-empty bottle of sweet, clear pisco sat on the table near his head. Jack approached the barkeep, still bent over his newspaper. His long, dark hair and beard were shot through with gray. He closed the paper and rose up, his keen brown eyes drawing a quick assessment. American? It wasn't really a question. That obvious, huh? Jack extended his hand. Name's Jack. Sands. They shook. A firm grip. He was an inch taller than Jack and leaner, but not in a good way. The crow's feet around his eyes were deeper than they should have been. Busted capillaries around his nose and rosacea on his forehead told the rest of the story. Sands was an alcoholic. Where you from, Jack?
Virginia.
Jack avoided references to D.C. whenever possible, especially with strangers.
Whereabouts in Virginia?
Alexandria. Never been.
So what the hell brings you to this shithole corner of the world?
You talking about the bar or the town?
Despite the alcoholism, Sands looked like he could still handle himself in a fight. But Jack was beyond caring what anybody thought about him. Luckily, Sands laughed.
Same difference.
He eyed Jack again.
Nobody ever comes here unless they got a story.
Maybe so. Jack's eyes narrowed. There was something weighing on Sands like a lead blanket. But the people who stay here have got the best ones.
That earned Jack a begrudging smile. His eyes searched Jack's for a moment. But for what, Jack couldn't tell.
Pull up a stool. I've got cold beer and warm whiskey and all the time in the world. What's your poison?
Jack normally didn't drink this early, but he was angry and depressed at the prospect of the climb delayed.
Beer. Dark or light?
Wet.
Coming right up, partner.
Sands reached down and pulled a beer out of the ice and popped the top as Jack grabbed a stool. The distant helicopter now roared overhead, its staccato thunder hammering the air and rattling windows. It passed by quickly.
What the hell was that?
A halo, Sands said. Big Russian bird, MI-26, a real heavy hauler.
What's it doing up here?
Hauling heavy shit would be my guess.
For who?
Whoever needs heavy shit.
Jack started to push back, but decided he really didn't care.
I think I'm gonna need a room.
Hourly or nightly?
Nightly.
You got one?
Sands set the Cusqueña Dorada in front of Jack.
Depends. You got cash?
Yeah.
Sands grinned, flashing tobacco-stained teeth. Then I've got a room.
How long are you staying?
Depends on the rain.
Supposed to stop tonight.
Jack did a quick calculation. If he could hike tomorrow, he could pull out on the noon bus the day after. His return ticket out of Lima was open-ended. He just needed to change the reservation.
Two nights.
That'll be 50 American.
Each night?
Total.
Jack lifted his beer.
Deal.
Sands clinked his whiskey glass against the bottle.
Skål.
Jack took a long pull as Sands tossed his off in a single slug.
Carlita back in the corner will take care of you right nice, but you gotta pay her husband $5 American if you want to throw.
I'm good, thanks. As Sands poured himself another, he asked,
So, what's your story, Jack?
No big deal.
I'm heading up to La Hermana to scatter the ashes of a friend.
Must have been some friend to come all the way out to this dump.
Jack snorted.
Yeah, well, he didn't quite describe the town like this.
I guess back in the day it was a nice little part of the world.
It was as pretty as a postcard until 5 years ago. Illegal gold mining on El Gordo is what brought the shit stains you see around here now. Poor bastards go swarming down into the mine like carpenter ants. No training, no gear, except maybe a helmet and a handpick. If they're lucky, they'll scrape out a few ounces in a week or two, but most of them aren't that lucky. The few that do get lucky are as likely to get a shiv between the ribs topside by a desperado too lazy or scared to brave the tunnels.
Why don't the authorities stop it?
People busy digging for gold are too tired to riot and too distracted to start a revolution.
He took a sip of whiskey.
Too bad.
It's beautiful country around here.
I used to run a little tour guide service back in the day. There's a lake that had the most gorgeous trout you've ever seen. But the mercury and other chemicals leaching into the water killed them off. I haven't seen a tourist here in years, especially an American one.
Kinda nice to hear a familiar accent.
Jack's eyes darted around the bar. He spotted a shot glass on a shelf behind Sands. It bore a familiar crest and a motto.
Sua sponte, Jack said, of their own accord.
Sands frowned, surprised.
You were in the 75th?
Me? No.
I did my tour of duty in expensive private schools with Jesuits beating Latin into us like we were rented mules. That earned another chuckle from Sans. But you were a ranger, Jack said. Sans's eyes narrowed. Why do you say that? Because you don't look like a Shriner. Jack nodded toward the shot glass. Hua, Sans said. He eyed Jack again. You weren't in the Rangers, but you look like you served. No, but I have friends who did, and my dad was a Marine. Where were you deployed? Wherever they fucking sent me. Sans's face clouded over, lost in a memory. I've got a friend who's a retired Ranger, a real stand-up dude by the name of Jankowski. Midas Jankowski? Sans asked, incredulous. Jack smiled, equally surprised. Yeah. Sans ran a hand through his long hair. Man, that young hoss pulled my bacon out of the fire more than once. How the hell is he? Tough as ever. Like every other ranger I ever met. Well, except maybe you, Jack thought. He finished his beer. Sans turned around and grabbed the ranger shot glass from the shelf, wiped it out with a bar rag, and splashed whiskey into it. He pushed it over to Jack and lifted his own glass. To Midas. To Midas. They tapped glasses and tossed back their whiskeys. Next time you see him, tell him... Sans's eyes glassed over. Tell him what? Nothing. Not a goddamn thing.